Welcome into Footnotes. Kevin Foote on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting from our First South Farm Credit Studio. Simulcast on Stadium 32.3 and 133 on LUS. Phone number 706-0111. 706-0111 on this glorious Thursday morning. Just did not expect that last night. I mean, it was one of those games that by the end was, a little too good. The Astros only scored 8 runs last night, which is not an overabundance of runs, but they got 17 hits. They out-hit the Red Sox 17-4. 17-4. They are now 5-1 against the Red Sox on the season with one more game tonight at 6:10 first pitch again, third straight 6:10. A lot of times on Thursday, getaway day, you have an afternoon game in that last game, but it's not the case tonight. 6:10 first pitch. You can hear that game again right here on 103.7 The Game. And just, I was thinking yesterday's game was they were going to have trouble winning. And then in the first inning, they, kind of, Odorizzi struggled. They're down 2-0. And then, they got a big hit from Miles Straw. Tony Walker, I've been calling him. And is Tony Walker been great this year? No. Does he have a lot of weaknesses that rear their ugly head at time and frustrate you? Yes. But I'm debating on whether or not I'm starting to think, and I don't want to change things too much, but I'm debating on stop, and my daughter would be very happy if I did this. My daughter Riley, stop calling him Tony Walker, because if you remember Tony Walker, I'd have to go back and look. I think he had like 93 at bats, and then he was opening day starter in 86. He had like 93 at bats, if I remember, somewhere right in there, and then we never heard from him again. Well, Straw, again, he's not a great hitter. For as fast as he is, he's not a great base runner. And, he doesn't go back on balls all that great. He's got issues, but he keeps getting hits. He drives in runs here and there for a little guy hitting in the bottom of the order who can't really hit all that well. He had a multi-hit game again last night. He is, he's not been as bad as I thought he was going to be. Let's put it that way. So I'm just saying I'm going to consider someone like him. I don't know if they can handle changing their nickname, but we'll see. I'm considering no longer calling him Tony Walker, and then we'll see how he does for a while. We'll see if we make that decision. But don't like getting 17 hits. You know that. I don't like getting 17 hits in a game ever unless it's, unless you're like in September or something and you've already clinched and you're just, you got another week or two of the season and you've already clinched and you're going to be playing some backups and all that. But man, yesterday was, going back to 17, maybe even a year before that, when they go to Fenway, they normally hit. And normally Bregman hits, which is good because Bregman has not been hitting at all. And he has not been hitting at all. And he's had some pretty good at bats in this series. He's had multiple doubles, balls where he's driving the ball, and then he hit the coup de grace 2-run homer last night to go from 6-3. To 8-3, because the Astros bullpen is what it is, and they've kind of put a different twist on that last night. at 6-3, you know, you're out hitting someone at the time. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was like 13-3. Like you're out. I think at the time they were out hitting them 13-3, but they were only up 6-3. And so you're like, kind of controlling the game, kind of dominating the game, but a three-run deficit is you. Teams have overcome three-run deficits before, and so I felt much better after Bregman's coup de grace three-run homer. I mean, two-run homer to make it 8-3, which was the final score. So that part is good. They've got, Brantley. Look, I mean, it was unbelievable. I'm like, Garrett Stubbs played last night, looked terrible offensively, and yet it didn't matter. And so if Odorizzi can be a functional starting rotation for what we hope is or what we're thinking is going to end up being a first-place team, if he can do that, then the Astros now have, if they stay healthy, once McCullers comes back, 7 starting pitchers. Like, it wasn't all that long ago, like the beginning of last season, when I was talking about saying things like, I don't know yet if we can count to 4. In fact, I even said more than once going into last season, I don't know if we can count to 3. Well, right now, we're counting to 7. Like, and I know the Dodgers, you know, the fans of the punks were talking about that in the preseason, but they have so many injuries, they can't count to 7. I don't know if they can count to 4. The Astros, if they stay healthy, once McCullers comes off the DL, which is supposed to be any week now, they're going to be able to count to 7. Wow. And so it creates an interesting, I'm not going to say dilemma, just scenario, because what they did last night is what you do in the postseason sometimes. And they've done it fairly often at times in the postseason. I kind of like it, but I don't know how much you can do that in throughout the course of a regular season. And what I'm talking about was Odorizzi pitched 5 innings. He threw too many pitches in the first inning. But still, he went 5 innings, gave up 3 hits, gave up 3 runs, but which is not great, but it's not awful. But he only gave up 3 hits in 5 innings. And then Christian Javier, who's a starting pitcher by trade, came in and pitched the final 4 innings. Which, that's more of a postseason thing than it is a regular season thing. But what it could, so how much, and it's the one question when we had Chandler on Monday. We only had him on for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and I wasn't able to get to everything because I hadn't talked to him yet this year. And that was the question that when he hung up, I was like, I didn't get to that question. I wish we could have gotten to it, and maybe we'll talk about that more in the future. But it's an interesting thing is, you know, you don't have a great bullpen. Your closer's done fine, but anything between the starters and the closers has not been a pretty sight this season. But if you, now that you can count to 7, or at least in a week or so, be able to count to 7. And when I mean count to 7, I mean you have 7 viable starting pitchers. Very few franchises have that. And that's with just losing Gerrit Cole not that long ago, and Verlander being, you know, who knows if his career's over or not after a major surgery at his age. And so, and you can still count to 7. That's just amazing to me. But anyway, that means when you have a 5-man rotation, what are you going to do with the other two, whoever they are? I mean, the thought process was that it was going to be Luis Garcia all along, but Luis Garcia's won 5 straight starts. You're really going to bench this guy? You're really going to take him out the rotation? Like, what if he wins his next start? That would be six straight wins. You're gonna demote a guy on a literal six game win streak. A lot of these win streaks they say pitchers have, I think, is a lie. It's deception. Because if your team loses and you get a no decision, you lost the game. Stop all that individual silliness. But this guy would really have a six-game winning streak if he won his next start. So I don't know that they'll be able to put him into the bullpen, demote him to the bullpen. I don't know. We'll see. But whoever it is, what that does is it's almost like you have two starters in one game, essentially. And if you remember, a couple years ago in the Astros minor league system, they were doing that. They were pitching guys. Basically, you have two starters. You know, one guy pitches five, the other one pitches four, or vice versa. And you kind of know that going in. Now, I guess if the Astros would have been up 10-1 in the sixth inning, which I would not have been very happy with. But let's say they were up 10-1 in the sixth inning or going to the sixth. They might have just thrown some of the donkey guys. They might have. But if you do the 5-4 thing once a week, or, you know, if you get to seven, you could theoretically do it twice a week. What it does is save your bullpen. Because you're not throwing a bunch of arms. Most teams, when a starting pitcher goes five, which I don't like, you need four pitchers to get through the rest of the game. Sometimes more, but you need four to get through the rest of the game. Well, if you do the 5-4 thing like the Astros did last night with Odorizzi and Javier, well, now, you know, Stanek didn't have to pitch, and Presley didn't have to pitch, and Taylor didn't have to pitch, and Rayleigh didn't have to pitch, etc. It's an interesting deal. Now, I don't know how much. The only problem with that is, like, the last time Javier pitched, he pitched like three plus innings, and they lost. So, like, it just seems almost like a waste. But when you win, you always feel a little better about it. And, wow, I mean, it's very interesting. What a great victory last night. I love crushing teams, but especially the high-profile teams from the ESPN division. That is really fun. Really fun. All right. We'll take a commercial break. When we come back, there's a couple lingering baseball issues that I've touched on a little bit, but haven't really delved into. So we'll do that next. And of course, you know, if you want to have calls about LSU baseball or the NBA, I'll have some comments on the NBA this show as well. Any of that, Saints talk, any of that, certainly feel free. Again, the phone number 706-0111. We'll take a commercial break. We'll be back. 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to Footnotes. Kevin Foote on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting from our First South Forum Credit Studios again. Simulcast on Stadium 32.3 and 133 on LUS. Phone number is 706-0111, 706-0111. If you have any questions, comments on any of the subjects that I brought up before we went to the break, certainly feel free to do it. I do want to talk about some of the heavy issues going on, or I don't know about it. Some of them are heavy in Major League Baseball that I didn't get to the last couple days, but kind of meant to, or thought that I was gonna and just never really got to it. Before we do that, I do want to, you know, the Phoenix Suns continue to look really good in the NBA playoffs. But I did want to throw out one thing. Someone called and said, if you had to make a prediction right now, who would you predict? And I said Suns as well. Here's the only thing about the Suns that I just want to throw out there. Let's say they go on to win this series, and I think they will, like almost everybody does. Sounds like the Denver head coach even believes that. But If that happens, as we're all thinking, let me ask you a question. Have they beaten a really good team yet? That's my only thing that I'm starting to think. Like, the Lakers team that they beat was not a good team. And when I say not a good team, I'm not comparing them to non-playoff teams. I'm comparing them to a team that many people considered contenders. They're not a good team because they were without one of their two best players, and they weren't deep enough to handle that. Well, so is Denver. So they will have beaten a shorthanded Laker team who was not good, and they will now have beaten a shorthanded Nuggets team. How good are they compared to, again, if you compare them to the 20th best team in the league, are they good? Yeah, but if you compare them to like a top 4 or 6 team, how good are they? So that's the only thing about the Suns. They look great. Everything that I've heard about them seems absolute. People are saying about it does not seem to be hyperbole. All seems to be true. But if things continue like they are, when they get to the finals, will they have actually beaten anyone? I don't know that you could say they really have. Just because those teams were shorthanded and really not playing at a high level. It's not like they went out, they played a team who played at a high level, and they beat them. Can't really say that. So that's the only thing in the back of my mind on the Suns to kind of consider as we analyze this stuff moving forward. Let's go to the phone lines. Hello.
Hey, I'm calling about Pete Rose. I think that what he does on the field counts. He might have a bad mark against him, but most of us do. So I'm all for Pete Rose. And I have another question to ask you.
Okay.
Why does the Southeastern Conference have 3 Tigers, 2 Bulldogs? Does anybody check that on their mascots?
So you don't like Tigers and Bulldogs being used, or you think there should only be 1 in each conference?
There's too many of them.
Well, I could go with that. All right. There are a lot of Tigers, but I guess they have that all over the country. I do actually like unique nicknames. And so I kind of actually do agree with the caller, and wish there would be more. Like, I wish Auburn would go with the, you know, War Eagles or whatever more often. War Eagles is a cool nickname. Tigers is, it's just so blah, and there's so many of them that I understand that point of view, and I do kind of like cool nicknames. But anyway, Pete Rose should never be in the Hall of Fame. And because he committed, and for the sport of baseball, the unpardonable crime. And when you commit the unpardonable crime, then you no longer can be pardoned. That's what unpardonable means. So he should never be pardoned, and he agreed to never be pardoned. So I understand the sentiment that because he got so many hits, and he did get a lot of hits. Now, I think overall Pete Rose was an overrated baseball player. He was the ultimate example of longevity over you know, truly special skills and all that. But still, I mean, when you get that many hits, if he hadn't bet on the game and committed the unpardonable sin, well, then he would be in. I mean, he would be first ballot, and I wouldn't argue with it, even though he is overrated, very overrated, arguably the most overrated baseball player ever. But he would certainly be in. But he committed the unpardonable sin, so he can't. But all of that kind of leads into what I wanted to talk about in this segment, and maybe in the next we'll see how it goes. The whole idea, like, there's been so much discussion about cheating. And for some people, this whole idea about cheating is a black and white issue, but in it depends what the cheating is. But in this case, I don't think it's a black and white issue. And I saw the interview or the Zoom interview with Garrett Cole from a couple days ago. And everyone's bashing him, and I get it. But it's not a yes or no answer. If you had to give a yes or no answer to the question, have you ever done it before? The answer is yes. I mean, he said a lot of words, and you could say he said a lot of words, and he didn't say anything. But the answer was yes, but that doesn't tell the whole story. Again, I think there's a lot of people out there that have this idea that the majority of the team is not cheating. I mean, the majority of the league, and that this is his, oh, he's putting stuff on the baseball. They're using technology to steal signs. Can you believe it? That's not the case. That's not the case. I don't think people... What Garrett Cole said, without using these exact words, was... They've been doing this way before I was born. The generation of the 19th century taught the early 19th century pitchers how to do it. That generation taught the next generation how to do it. That generation taught the next generation of pitchers how to do it. And that generation taught us how to do it. We're just doing what's been done since the 19th century when the game started. They taught us how to do it. Now, he seemed to say in the middle of all of that, or indicate that there's some sort of line that you shouldn't go over. Like Michael Pineda. Like, you know, these guys use these substances, but you can't have a whole glob of it on your neck for the camera to catch. I don't know. That's kind of like, that's so stupid, like banging trash cans. That's really stupid. So, it's not a black and white issue. It's very complicated. Now, I ask you this question. We got to go to the break, but I'm asking this question before the break, and then I want to further investigate this. If 100% of the teams have pitchers who are doing this, who's cheating? Who's getting cheated? Who has an advantage? Here's my problem with all this. Major League Baseball artificially legislates changes in the games by putting in hot baseballs. Are they cheating the pitchers by juicing the balls? Yeah. But it affects everyone, so it's not cheating. That's what people would say. But so the pitcher said, wait a minute, if you're going to juice all these balls, then we're going to start doing this stuff even more than we're already doing it. Oh, this is awful. We need to crack down on the pitchers. They're all cheating. Well, wait a minute. They've been doing this for over 100 years, and you're juicing the baseballs, helping the hitters. Now the pitchers are trying to fight back, and we're trying to vilify all the pitchers. That's all a bunch of hogwash to me. Just leave the game alone and stop all that foolishness. Anyway, we'll take a commercial break. We'll come back more with that on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to Footnotes. Kevin Foote on 103.7 The Game. Want to remind you about our Dad Doesn't Need Another Tide sweepstakes. Go to 1037thegame.com. You've probably heard about it before. If you haven't done it, you're running out of time. So go to the website, 1037thegame.com. sign up for the Rewards Club, and if you do so, you might win a $500 Visa gift card. It's part of our Dad Doesn't Need Another Tie sweepstakes powered by Cajun Gun and Gear and 103.7 The Game, Acadiana's sports station. All right, so we were talking, you know, this whole idea. I mean, am I getting some, you know, little kind of what you would call petty enjoyment out of guys like Trevor Bauer and Gerrit Cole getting their baseballs checked in there, fingers being pointed at them that, you know, that they're you know, using these illegal substances on the baseballs. Yeah, but again, it's not just them. That's just, again, that's some, we've celebrated. It's kind of like we celebrate the career of Gaylord Perry. And put him in the Hall of Fame and wink, wink, he used a spitball and he did all, and we celebrate that as gamesmanship. And then when it becomes not PC anymore, then we want to vilify all these people as thieves and cheaters. When it's part of the game, it's kind of like the NFL celebrated the NFL, not networks. Well, through the networks, but the NFL for years put together these big hit films about shows and these defensive backs crushing on it was the great part of the game and come watch this. And then now we want to vilify them. The NFL put together shows, talked about how cool was going on in the sidelines when these people have these little kangaroo courts and they had this little bag or whatever, and they'd all put money in, and when you got a big interception or a big sack or caused a fumble, so-and-so and would go and get the money in the pot. He'd win the money for the pot in whatever bag, kind of creative bag they put in. The NFL did this. It was part of their NFL films decades ago. And then later, oh, that's terrible when you do that. We got to suspend your coach for the whole year. Wait a minute. Weren't just a decade ago you doing NFL films laughing about this and how this was part of the game? So I just struggle with that whole deal of trying to vilify all these pitchers. I think the word cheating is one that I use a lot, but I think it's being misused in this case. What I look at it at, just like steroids was the same thing. It's why I get so sick of hearing people like Bob Costas talk about this. It's about artificially creating a change in the game. And when you juice baseballs, which essentially they did in the 20s and 30s, they juiced the baseballs. And all of a sudden, everybody started hitting home runs. Well, they weren't hitting home runs 10 years before. They weren't hitting it hardly any. and just like in the 60s when they did stuff with the mound. So they artificially altered the way the game is played. That's been going on for a century. It's not a new concept. But when baseball does it, then they're basically cheating too. So when other people cheat to adjust to the – when baseball cheats the game by juicing the ball to produce more hitting, or when the commissioner after the 94 strike turned a blind eye to the steroids because chicks digged the long ball and they wanted to get the fans back because they know the fans are a bunch of microwave generation people that have to have the home run to enjoy the game. Well, then all of a sudden we want to just make all these hitters who were taking steroids like they're the devil and, oh, man, they cheated and they can't be in the Hall of Fame. That's just a bunch of hogwash. And that's kind of what this is. So I just – if you want to take it out of the game or penalize it more, but if they go overboard and start treating these guys like they're just these, I think that's awful. Let's go to the phone lines. Hello.
Good morning. You had to bring up the Bounty Gate. I mean, I was just on hold.
It's true.
I mean, number one, my favorite word is hogwash. I'm gonna say it all day. This is hogwash. I don't understand. And number two, you're gonna pass out one day when you go on one of your rants and talk to you out of breath. They're gonna find you just sleeping in the studio.
It's possible.
Take a breath, man. Take a breath. So I like your logic though. 100% of the people were doing it. Then who's getting cheated?
Yes.
I hate to agree with you, but it's kind of true. But, you know, baseball is like, it's too different. I don't know. I guess my question is, how about let's dig up Babe Ruth? Let's see if he cheated. Let's dig him up, do a little test, see if he had a little steroids in him.
Well, of course he cheated. Yeah, he cheated.
But, I mean, what would they do back then to cheat?
Well, but again, the game cheated. Because what happened was shortly before Babe Ruth, it's not cheated so much as they cheated the stats. Well, shortly before Babe Ruth came into prominence, or right as he was coming into prominence, a guy got hit with a ball and he died. Well, they started changing the whole idea. They started using white balls instead of muddy ball looking balls, and they started using more balls, kind of like they do now. Because now, if you notice, they didn't do that when we were kids. Every time the ball even touches the ground, they throw it out. They didn't do that when we were kids. These hitters are hitting new balls all the time, and the pitchers are using these new balls. All of this affects the game, and so the game totally changed by some that had nothing to do with the skill of the hitters when Babe Ruth started hitting all them home runs. And as far as what he did to cheat, like, they were cheating in the 19th century like crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. But before I go on your little promo, can we put Pelican Park at the end? When they hit you the ball, your job is to catch it. That's my favorite promo of all time.
And people say that's not right. Like, isn't that true?
It's 100% true. You can guarantee it. It's a guarantee. It's like I told my wife, it's a guarantee. If they hit a foul ball and let the third baseman, he's riding and he drops it, I'll put my life mortgage on that the guy's getting the hit the next pitch.
Oh, it's amazing. It. Yes, it's
it
amazing.
Happens. Have a good day.
Take care. And there's another thing along that line I want to get to. I don't know if we'll get to it in this segment, maybe next hour. Let's go back to the phone lines. Hello.
Hey, good morning, Kevin. How you doing?
Good morning.
Hey, listen, you know, the thing that bothers me the most about raising the mound, juicing the ball, raising the seams on the baseballs, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, anything that they do is the fact that it's cheating the history of baseball. And, you know, I guess I'm getting old, and I'm one of those people that I hear people say, you know, could Frank Howard or Fred Valentine or, you know, those guys that I watched in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore as a kid, could they hit today? And if they hit today with a juice ball, how many home runs would they hit and stuff like that? Well, the answer is you'll never know. But I wish that they would in some way standardize the game now. And the balls evolved from, you know, the 1930s to what we have now, and the bats evolved to what we have now. But the fact is that we're at a point now that we can standardize it and say, okay, it's not going to change. Because the next thing you know, they're going to put metal bats in it, and then you're going to have people hitting 100 home runs.
Well, we don't want that. But look, on some of this day, there's no way of changing. For instance, so there hasn't been anyone hit 400 since 1941. So you think there hadn't been any great hitters since 1941? No, the game changed. The gloves got better. The players got faster. There's just the fielding got better. The scoring is probably different than now than it was 100 years ago, the way the official scored a game. And there's all kind of different things that kind of just change as part of natural order that I don't know that there's anything. But yeah, juice balls to me is going above and beyond the kind of stuff I'm just was talking about.
Yeah, the scorekeeping and the change there is instant replay. A scorekeeper can go back and watch an error eight times before he determines if it was an error. In 1930, there was no instant replay. In 1940, there was no instant replay. So it was what that guy saw from the press box and probably while he was drinking a beer and talking to one of his buddies, you know. And nowadays, they can go back and look at it and look at it and look at it, and 3 days later, you'll get a ruling that something has been changed to an error.
Right.
So, you know, it was when the Miami Dolphins had their great run. What was the name of the big running back that played? And they went back, and he had 997 yards at the end of the season, and 2 weeks after the season, he had 1,003 because they went back and watched replays and gave him an extra 6 yards. So that has changed. But I think that there are things that they can do. The other thing is that if you're going to juice the balls, then raise the mound. You know, if you're going to give one side an advantage, then give the other side an advantage too.
I think that's fair. I appreciate the call, Dave. Thank you very much. Good hearing from you again. All right, let's get one more call before the break. Hello. Hello.
He hung up.
He hung up. Okay. All righty. Well, no, I think Dave's call is good. I just think there's way too many people out there who went media members, fans, who just seem to be a little on the naive side. Like, I understand these guys are technically cheating. And again, if you get caught, then you got to pay the penalty. But that doesn't mean you just throw out everything. That's where I disagree. And that's, I think the idea of quote-unquote cheating is misperceived. It's just like in the steroid era. If you believe these reports, I'm not saying no one got cheated, because some did. If you honestly didn't ever do it, then you got cheated, no question. But if 65 to 70% of the league was doing it at the height, you know, 25 years ago, like people are suggesting, then who was getting cheated? Not many teams were getting cheated. If two-thirds of the league was doing it, not many teams were getting cheated. Now, individual players like Frank Thomas claims he never did it. So Frank Thomas's 30 home runs in that era were, if they were totally quote-unquote legit, while other people were hitting 50 and were using it, then individuals got cheated, and I understand them feeling that way. But I don't know if any teams really got cheated. If two-thirds or over of the league were using and were doing what baseball was allowing them to do for their own selfish reasons, then who got cheated? It's about advantage and competition. Now, if you violate the rule, whether you get an advantage in competition or not, then you violated the rule, and if you get caught, you get penalized. I got no issue with that. Should get penalized. There's a rule. There's a penalty. You get caught. It's proven. You suffer the consequences. That's the way. I got no issue with that. But that doesn't mean you gained an advantage, a competitive advantage. And by the way, nothing gives you more of a competitive advantage on the playing field than when the referees or the league cheat you. Nothing does, in my opinion. And I think that's something else that a lot of people disagree with me on, and I believe I'm right and they're wrong. But anyway, we'll take a commercial break. We'll finish out the first hour next on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to 103.7 The Game. Want to remind you about our Astro Weekend Getaway. Getting close to the end of that one as well. Go to 103.7thegame.com. Astros White Sox. You could get 4 tickets to Astros White Sox game on Saturday, June the 19th. Who knows? By then, that they may have the two best records in the whole league. We'll see. They're not that far from having that right now, but the Rays win every day, so that may not happen. But anyway, four tickets to Astros White Sox Saturday, June the 19th, and a $200 Visa gift card. But you can't win if you don't join. So go to the website, 1037thegame.com. Take part in our Astro Weekend Getaway brought to you by Butcher Air Conditioning, JJ Exterminating, and 1037 The Game, Acadiana Sports Station. All right, this kind of reminds you of a family argument we were having. When was that? Over the weekend or Memorial Day? Sometime recently. Anyway, we like to play games a lot in our family. So, and we play cards, card games, and all kind of different card games. So we were having the discussion the other night. Is it cheating to look at other people's hands? Is that cheating? I think that's cheating.
Yes.
Like, yeah, I think that's cheating. Like, my wife and nieces and daughters, they just look at people's hands and they think it's just part of the game. Well, maybe it is part. Well, they're not holding their hands. Well, I don't look. Like, when I play cards, I look at my hand. I don't try to look. I intentionally try to look away if someone's kind of holding their hands out a little too far. So is that cheating if someone's holding your hands out a little too far? Kind of like Major League Baseball said, oh, yeah, we're doing steroids. That's okay. We want to get the fans back. It's kind of like holding your hands out a little too far. So should you look? And if you do, is it cheating? Nick says yes. I agree with Nick. I think that's cheating. They say no, it's not cheating. The person was holding their hands out too far. That wasn't really cheating. And then all these eye contact. See, I try not to look at my partner when I'm playing because if you do, that's cheating. But they say no, that's not cheating. That's just part of the gamesmanship of the game. All this eye contact. And giving out clues like bathing is a lonely business. You know, you give out clues like that, and that's just cheating. They say no, so I don't know. I guess I have more cheating and rule. I guess I have more rules integrity in playing cards than I do in my Major League Baseball and NFL. We'll take commercial break. Another hour next, 1037 The Game. Welcome back to Footnotes. Kevin Foote on 103.7 The Game, broadcasting from our First South Farm Credit Studios. Simulcast on Stadium 32.3 and 133 on LUS. Phone number 706-0111, 706-0111. We had some really good calls in the last hour. We've been talking about baseball and cheating and all of the in and outs of that. It is, I think, a fascinating issue. And I don't know that there is an answer. And again, I've not been happy with Gerrit Cole since the shenanigans he pulled at the end of Game 7 of the World Series a couple years ago. But I do understand the position that he was in. And this idea out there that he should have just given a yes, yes, I did, and that's the end of it, and there is no black and white, and there is no gray area to this, I think is a naive point of view there, very naive. And so I think there's so many things that impact statistics and trends in the game, and some of them are natural. Like, Joe DiMaggio was a great player, and Ted Williams was a great hitter. But do I think that Joe DiMaggio could have hit 56 straight games today? No, I don't think he would. And I don't think Ted Williams would have hit 400 today. Not saying they aren't great players, because they were, and I think they would be great players today. But in today's world, back then, they didn't have all these specialized relief pitchers that would come in the seventh, eighth, and ninth inning just to get you out. Back then, a lot of teams, their pitchers went 8 and 9 no matter what. And so I don't. It's just the game's different now. You have all these specialty players that are coming in just to get guys out in high leverage situations. They didn't face that back in the 30s and 40s. And I think outfielders had more range. The average outfielder now has more range than they had back then. Now, the ballparks are smaller, so there's give and take and all that. But, again, you got to take all of this stuff into account. It's what I call putting things through a filter. And I just think there's not nearly enough filters being used when people analyze and compare generations or analyze what's cheating and what's not cheating and what impacts the game and what doesn't impact the game. And that's why I think most of the national and even local, most people's analysis of the steroid era, I think is wrong. I think it's off base. Now, it's not totally wrong. They're not, you know, did a lot of them lie? Yeah, they lied. But I don't know. I just think there's a lot of people that are not viewing all of this correctly. And so I think if you listen to what Gerrit Cole was saying, he brought up some of the issues that complicated. And people still say, well, if you cheat, well, again, be careful with that. The Yankees for sure need to be careful with it, and I think the Dodgers need to be careful with it because it's come out in recent weeks that we talked about that they were doing the same thing to other teams in the same era, and it's just funny the way that works. All right, I kind of almost feel bad because Saints hater called, and he was very complimentary, and I'm about to say something the later on in the show about the Bears. I do want to kind of make some progress today, even though we're talking about a lot of these other subjects. Do want to make some progress today on our footnote summer project. And we need to make some, we're going to make a little more Saints progress. We probably have, 25 or 30 Saints suggestions here, and we only have about 8 or 10 NFL overall non-Saints suggestions, and most of them come from the Giants. It's amazing how that worked out. But I do want to mention a couple others, and so we want to do some of that, make some of that progress this hour as well. If you want to talk about the NBA, I did have some thoughts on the Suns. You know, it's funny. I think this round of the playoffs is going to be less exciting than the first round. I don't know really why that is. I guess you start, there seems to be a bigger difference. Of course, you got more series in the first round, and you have obviously half the series in this round than you have in the last round. But you know, some of those series, there seem to be more competitive series. You would think that series would get more competitive, and they seem to have gotten less competitive. Now, I think this Sixers-Hawks series is going to be competitive. I think the Jazz-Clippers series is going to be competitive, but the jury's still out on that. I don't think it doesn't look like the other two series are going to be very competitive at all. So, you know, even if you just go percentages to make up for the fact that you have half the series, I mean, I think more than 50% of this first round series were competitive, and I think maybe 50% of these will be, and it could be just 25% is going to be competitive in this round. So we'll see how that plays out. But certainly any thoughts on the NBA, is on the table. Also, LSU baseball. I heard at the top of the hour, and we discussed that there's the head coach part of this, which can be a complicated issue. Talking about gray area versus black and white. For some people, that's a black and white issue. And some people, there's a levels of gray. I think I kind of thought LSU, and maybe I was being naive here, would go more from a kind of a young go-getter kind of coach than another older coach, because they've had Well, I guess Skip wasn't that old, but all of our thoughts of Skip was, you know, most of our memories of Skip was him as an old guy. I'd have to go back and look. I don't know exactly how old he was when he got the job in, what, 86 or so, but I don't. But he always looked old anyway. But they've kind of always had an old coach. And I kind of thought they would go a little younger, and if they get Case, you know, he's on the older side. Experience. Now, again, with age comes experience. With age comes a lot of accomplishment in his case. And then, obviously, he had that controversial issue when he was at Oregon State, and there's going to be a lot of difference of opinion there. Again, so much has to do with timing. And do you want any of those kind of issues now? So at LSU, with everything going on, you know, around other programs at LSU in the last year or so. So I don't know. Very complicated issue. Lots of different points of view there, I'm sure, and we'll see how that plays out. On the field, playing Tennessee. Like I said earlier in the week, I think that Tennessee's probably better, but that doesn't mean that LSU can't win. It's just a conference series. LSU's beaten some good teams in conference series. That's essentially what it is. It's a weekend conference series that in the SEC that just means more. So it will certainly be interesting to see how that plays out. And if you have any thoughts on the Women's College World Series, we haven't talked as much about that as I guess I thought we would. Personally, I'm pulling for Florida State to win. We'll see what happens. Let's go to the phone lines. Hello.
Kevin, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, all right, so first we keep forgetting about Smoke LaValle in between Skip Burton.
Yeah, another old guy.
And they went from Skip Berman to Smoke LaValle. And that was old to old.
Yeah.
You know, and you're always going to have that. It's hard to follow in somebody's shoes and footsteps. So traditionally, and I know the way you think, kind of superstitiously, but when you follow somebody with great history, it's hard to repeat and keep it up. You almost have like an odd year where whoever's going to follow up is going to have a hard time, and then that person's successor is going to do great, you know. In all sports, LSU baseball on the field, I think it showed that they were battle tested whenever they went to Oregon. And I'm hoping and praying that with the familiarity with Tennessee, them being a conference foe, that it plays in our favor. It's a positive thing. And secondly, I think that if you look at traditionally LSU teams in the past, they tend to get hot at the SEC tournament and in the regionals, and then they cool off in the super regionals. This seems to be happening a little later in the year. They didn't find their bats. They didn't learn how to stop focusing on growing long hair and beards and focus on hitting the baseball at the end of a regional and had to pull it out, and they started getting hot there. So maybe that carries them through the super regional. I think maybe they might be peaking. It's all about that peak time, right?
Oh, that's important. I think the thing that's different here is you touched on one of them, and that is, you know, you're facing a familiar foe, which I don't know that that's a good thing. Time will tell. The other facet of this matchup compared to, you know, going deep into a regional is you're going to face fewer guys in the bottom of the other team's bullpen in a three-game series than you would, I think, in the fourth or fifth game of a regional. So we'll see how that plays out as well.
Yeah, I think the only disadvantage to a three-game and not a regional is, like you said, they don't even have to go to their bullpen. They can do the 5-4 like Astros are doing. They can, you know, and which is basically what LSU had to do in the last game against Oregon. Landon Marceau was back on the mound as a reliever.
Yes.
So, you know, Tennessee might pull the 5-4 on LSU. But we'll see. And my thoughts are LSU's just peaking right now, and going from an old coach to another old coach is not always good. It's the second man after the success always has a lot of trouble. But thanks for taking my call.
No, thank you. Thank you for calling. You too, sir. Now, the only other thing I'll say about that is I don't think, and he's right, a lot of people say, you know, who you want to be the one that follows the legend, but I don't think Paul Mannieri's in that status, at least in the court of public opinion. I don't think he's in that status. I don't think that whoever ends up following him is gonna be like walking in a shadow. I don't think it's gonna be like what Smoke had to go through. I don't believe that. So I think that whoever it is, especially someone like Casey, I mean, again, if you hire someone who's won multiple national championships, then, you know, they're highly successful and have all the confidence in the world. They don't really have to prove anything. They've already done that. So I think it's going to be a little easier this time around. But it will be a very interesting choice that they make, and it will get, I mean, when you have a program that a lot of people are passionate about, it's going to get scrutinized no matter which way you go. It's just, I just kind of thought they'd go a little younger, but we'll see how that plays out. Take a commercial break. We'll be back. 103.7 The Game. To Footnotes, Kevin Footer, 103.7 The Game. Phone number 706-0111, 706-0111. Want to remind you, go to the website, 1037thegame.com. Sign up for the Rewards Club, and you might win one of two gift certificates to Cypress Bayou, a $150 gift certificate to Mr. Lester Steakhouse, or a $25 gift certificate to Mabel's Kitchen at Cypress Bayou. So you want to sign up, put yourself in position to win by going to 1037thegame.com. All right, I said I wanted to add a little bit more before tomorrow be our final day of NFL week on the NFL side. A great victory, a great feel-good victory. I think a couple come to mind for me other than the ones that we already talked about earlier this week. One of them was, it's probably a little too technical to count on this category, but I'll do it anyway. I don't know if you remember, we've told this story before in recent months. I don't remember exactly when, but the Saints in 1990 were going into the final weekend, and they needed something to happen that you don't normally do. The Saints were rooting for the Falcons. The Saints on the Sunday needed the Falcons to beat the Cowboys and then them beat the Rams to make the playoffs. And so that felt good watching the Falcons beat the Cowboys when normally as a Saints fan, you kind of felt dirty pulling for the Falcons, but since they won for you, I don't know, there was something that kind of just at the time felt good that a team that you hate was doing dirty work to help you. It's kind of a weird scenario there. Another one was 1985, for me anyway. The Chicago Bears, Mike Ditka, they were going for, Buddy Ryan, I should say, was going for an undefeated season, and it was kind of late in the season, and they were just dominating everybody. And everyone thought they were just absolutely unbeatable. And they played a Monday night game of all places, Miami. And the Dolphins beat them. And kind of took it to them. Like, the Dolphins' offense kind of took it to them, made a lot of big plays. So that was a really good feel-good win for me. Because I kind of grew up in the 70s as a little kid liking the Dolphins. You know, liked Shula, liked Marino. You know, I like a lot of Dolphins. Benny Malone and Zonka and Warfield. I think Warfield's one of the prettiest wide receivers ever. So I kind of like the Dolphins. I didn't like when they cheated the Saints in that game in 1980 that we talk about here and there. But I kind of like the Dolphins. And so that one felt good. I never hated Brett Favre. And he was a really good player in the NFC, in the Saints were in the NFC. Now, a lot of the time he was good, like in the late 90s in the NFC. The Saints were terrible, so it didn't matter in the Ditka years. So, but I didn't really root for him, ever really root for him. But a lot of people get caught up in the emotion of moments. And when he had that great Monday night performance, what was it, a day or two after, whenever it was, his dad died, or I don't know, it might have even been the day. I don't remember the exact time difference there, but his dad died, and he went out and had this great performance on Monday Night Football. Those kind of things, just normal, basic human compassion, you kind of you would, you know, call it a great victory or a great performance or a feel-good win, just a win that makes you feel good for, you know, either the team or the player or anything like that. There were a lot of people that looked at, for whatever reason, people really like Andy Reid. And when they won the Super Bowl, I felt good because they beat the Cheaters. But a lot of people felt good because they... You know, Andy Reid, who a lot of people highly respect but had never won a Super Bowl, felt good that he finally won a Super Bowl. So that was, in a lot of people's mind, that was like a real significant, like a great victory or one that made him feel good. So any non-Saints games, I wanted to bring up a few of those. Certainly would like your opinions. I mean, so many of them, again, have to do with redemption stories or rivalries. And, you know, getting back to the Saints, probably the number one on this list that epitomizes what we're talking about is the Katrina game. Like, we haven't even mentioned the Katrina game yet. Because in and of itself, it wasn't a real significant win. I mean, they went to 3-0. It put them 3-0, so that was, you know, and they beat a rival in the Falcons, so that was somewhat significant. But it wasn't like this historically significant win. It was game 3 of a season. You know, it wasn't like to go to the playoffs or to win a playoff game. It was to go to 3-0, which was, at that time, seemed unbelievable. Really, I mean... Remember, you're coming off a Katrina season. No one really knew what they had with Drew Brees yet. You know, as I remember, you know, in the first game of that year, the Saints beat the Cleveland Browns on the road, but it wasn't this great offensive performance. It was just they did okay. Now, the second game, they put up some pretty good numbers, as I remember. I don't have those numbers memorized, but that second game that year in 2006, they put up some pretty good numbers in winning to go to 2-0. But obviously, the significance of the Katrina game was just playing it in you. I mean, it was just, I was there. It was one of, you know, people probably overused that word surreal, but that was a surreal experience, just being there. You know, we had, you know, after Katrina, it was just, there were so many thoughts that it, you know, the Saints were just never going to play a game in the Superdome again. This, you know, who knew what was going to happen in the Superdome? And any time that I ever get into what I call like the bowels of the Superdome since then, I walk in and I kind of think, what was going on in this particular corridor or hallway? You know, during hurricane, you try to think of all the awful things that people were having, the misery that people were going through who were in there, and this, that hopelessness. I mean, it was just awful. And then now I'm just walking through it, and it's just a football arena again, or, you know, an all-purpose. But, I mean, it's you know, it looks normal and nice now, but think about what was going in that building. During that, it's just it can really change your perspective on a lot of things. But it was awful, and yet that night, it just felt, I mean, that was probably the greatest feel-good, satisfying victory of all time, just because of everything that it represented. And then, obviously, the game itself was awful. I mean, if you're judging it as a football game, it was, you know, the Saints punched him in the mouth and basically the game was over. I mean, it was, what was the final score? Like 21-3. And they, you know, the most of the second half, they were just playing the game out. So in and of itself, it wasn't really, there were a few exhilarating moments, like obviously the Gleason block punt to start it all off and Deloach recovers it. I mean, that was just, as a moment, I mean, there's different kinds of great moments. Obviously, the interceptions in the championship game and in the Super Bowl were for different reasons, but that moment was just on a different, whole different category. But the game itself was not a great game, just as a game, if you're just judging one game from another. But obviously the meaning of it was so deep and rich and, you know, made you feel so, I mean, it was just a whole different, it's almost in its whole different category. But for the purposes of this week's project, you would have to put it number one. And we hadn't even mentioned yet, but you have to put it number one. And there's a couple that precede that we haven't mentioned yet I'll do that when we get back, and then, you know, we can get on other subjects as well. But, yeah, certainly any more Saints nominations or suggestions that you have, as well as overall NFL ones, certainly would like to hear those. We'll take a commercial break. We'll be back on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to Footnotes. Kevin Foote on 103.7 The Game. Phone number 706-0111. 706-0111. Want to remind you, go to our website, 1037thegame.com. You might win a $40 gift card to Dickie's Barbecue Pit. Can't win, though, if you don't join. So go to 1037thegame.com, join the Clubhouse Rewards, and hopefully, possibly, maybe, you can win a $40 gift card to Dickie's Barbecue Pit. So take advantage and go sign up today. All right. There were two other games that I wanted to talk about that felt extra special to me. They don't compare to the Katrina game that I was just talking about. But one of them was the beginning game of the Katrina season. If you remember, right after Katrina, there were all kind of like, what in the world's going to happen? There were rumors the Saints were going to go to San Antonio, which, you know, a glass half full guy like me would never believe that. Just block that out. I don't even believe that. But that first game, they went to Orneville and won the game. Now, it turns out the Saints were terrible that year, and we all understand, you know, all the reason, the many reasons why that was. But it still felt great. It was still a great victory in and of itself, even though the team turned out to be terrible that year. To go to Orneville and to beat them, you know, after everything and all the uncertainty that had happened because of Hurricane Katrina, that was a real good feel-good win. And it was interesting because it was kind of a bookend in a weird way. The 2004 season, before we even knew what Hurricane Katrina was, it was the Saints went to Orneville, the last game of the previous season, and both teams were mathematically still in it. And whoever, they needed help, and whoever won, if they got that help, would go to the playoffs. And what the help the Saints needed was they needed the Jets to win, and the Jets were in great position to win, and they choked like dogs. But still, it felt great that in that a game that where it was kind of like do or die, it was do and maybe get rewarded or die and have no chance, that they went to Orneville and won that game. So that was kind of two bookend games in Arnoville, which, by the way, for those of you who don't know what Arnoville, that's what I call Charlotte, playing the Carolina Panthers. And the Saints won both of those games. The last game they played before Katrina and the first game they played after Katrina. And so those were kind of good feel-good games for an old-school Saints fan like myself. Let's go back to the phone lines. Hello.
Hey, Kevin.
Howdy.
I'm going to give you one that I don't know if you've talked about it. Probably not, because it really isn't really that significant of a game, other than it just, which you said, just gave me a lot of personal satisfaction. And just, it was the game against the 49ers in the early 90s, when we finally beat them at home. I don't know if it was like 93, maybe. It seemed like we would always lose these heartbreaking, low-scoring games, or they'd pull it out at the end against us at home when we had the good defenses, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s. And I just remember being there, and after the game, I was just so happy and just almost relieved that we finally beat them, because so many times it would be on some kind of cheating thing where it was controversial and, you know, it would seem like we'd outplay them, but they'd still end up with the win. Do you remember the game I'm talking about? I think it may have been 93. I think it was when Steve Young was quarterbacking.
I'd have to go back and look. I mean, they beat them.
We lost one, like, on the beginning of the season, like on a Monday night, like a 13-10 game.
Well, 13-12 and 90. But that last game, when they played, they beat the Cheaters the second to last game of that, where they had to beat the Rams on that Monday night. Was that in San Francisco or was that in New Orleans? I don't remember.
I think that was in San Francisco. Okay. We never seemed to beat them in New Orleans during those years. I just remember I was so, you know, had been so disappointed different times that this game just gave me a lot of satisfaction.
No, I understand.
I remember at the end of the game, I said, we're not leaving. We're just going to stay and enjoy this. Let everybody leave. Went down to the parking lot, listened to a lot of the post-game show, let all the traffic go just to try and just savor the moment. And one of the most disappointing, I know I've told you this before, it was the closest I probably ever came to breaking my TV, was that year when we really weren't that good, but we made the playoffs, was that 90? And we were playing the Bears in the playoffs? May have been January of 91 would have been the playoff if it was the 90 season.
Yeah, it was the 90 season, yes.
And we blocked the field goal, run it back for the touchdown to give us the lead, have all the momentum, and then they throw some weird flag almost after the fact and say somebody was lined up or something slightly over, some guy way off to the edge. It didn't even have anything to do with anything, and it nullified it, and then they gave them a first down, or they got to re-kick the field goal and made the field goal, so it was a 10-point swing. And I believe that game ended like 16-6.
Right.
So that, plus, it was just a momentum swing. You know, I'm convinced that if we get that touchdown on that blocked field goal, which we earned, we win that game. Because the Bears were not real good. They weren't good on offense either.
Especially since the Bears defensive end, Richard Dent, was one of
those guys who
was lined up in the neutral zone every play of his entire career.
So many times during the game, and they wouldn't call it.
Yeah.
And then they're going to call it on a critical play like that.
And it goes to something, it goes to something I said earlier that not enough people agree with, in my opinion. The greatest advantage teams get on the play, on the field, is when the league or the officials cheat them. It's not when the other team is cheating them, Because you already suspect that the other team is trying to cheat you. That's why you give signs that need to be stolen. That's why on the sideline they have guys in front and they're trying to hide the signals they're given, or they have these crazy signs with all these weird symbols. You already know the other team's trying to cheat you, but you don't plan for the league cheating you or the officials cheating you. That's where you get the biggest advantage.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just convinced that with that block field goal, we win the game.
No,
the same way I'm pretty convinced if Jared Cook doesn't fumble the thing last year in the playoff game against Tampa Bay, I'm pretty sure we win that game. I mean, there's no way to prove it, or you can't ever know for sure, but it just – but there's so many games, but those are just some that, you know, I mean, I could give you a whole list of different ones over the years.
So did you remember the 37-6 win over the Falcons? I don't know if you were listening earlier this week. We all talk about that trio of heartbreaking losses to the Falcons, but too many people forget about how great it felt to go to Atlanta and crush them that second meeting in 79.
That doesn't really seem that it doesn't stand out to me that I can really have that much memory of that game.
That's because you're getting too old.
Maybe so. I was in 79.
79.
Was that the year we had when we first kind of had a pretty good defense? And we were playing pretty good in 79?
It was up and down. The defense, as I remember.
When was the year our defense was pretty? Was it 78?
I don't know. I mean, we had some good defensive games in that. You know, 79 was the Raider Monday night game where the defense was just completely collapsed in 79. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have some good games.
Didn't we almost make the playoffs one of those years?
Well, yeah, 78.
78, then that must be the year I'm thinking of.
Well, we weren't that far from the playoffs in 79. If we had won that Raider game, we had a very, very realistic chance of making the playoffs.
And then was it what was the year with the against the Rams in the playoffs where we dominated them with Lance?
That was 83. Yeah, 83. That was post Ricky Jackson draft, and so yeah, we were real good defense in that era.
Oh, that was another really disappointing one.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I appreciate the call. Thank you, Noah. All wins against the cheaters are great. Now I'm trying to. It might have been – there was one where a backup quarterback played, and it might have been – I need to look it up – the game he just brought up. I think a backup quarterback played in that game for the cheaters. But who would that have been? I'll try to look it up. But I'm trying to place the exact game he's talking about. And I think it was a game where a backup quarterback played. But during the break, I'll try to get the details of that game. But no, I don't care what the details are. All victories, obviously, over the cheaters are significant, and they count as great feel-good wins for someone like me, for sure. Well, it wasn't. Anyway, let's get to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Foot, it's Joey. How you doing?
Hey.
I've been out of town, so I've missed a lot of this. But the one that popped to mind, of course, the non-Saint game, I'm sure it's been talked about, was the Falcons blowing the Super Bowl. Not the first time, the second time, the 28-3. Debacle.
That has been mentioned. Yes,
that team's been on a downward spiral since they scored that 28th point. Think about it. Since they scored that 28th point, that team's basically been a mess. And it's as much as you hate the Niners, I hate the Falcons. So I take great pleasure in their angst. But the Saints game, to me, that's my favorite, and it even surpasses the championship game against Minnesota, which I thought was better than the Super Bowl, although winning the Super Bowl was the pinnacle, but the game itself, that Minnesota game, was priceless. But on 1990 New Year's Eve, the Saints played the Rams when the Rams were in our division still, and it was a playoff spot on the line, and it basically came down to a Morton Anderson field goal, which was actually blocked with a few seconds left in the game, but the Rams had jumped off sides, and they ended up re-kicking it and made it, which sent the Saints to the playoffs. And back then, playoff appearances were very scarce, so it was really special. And even more importantly, I had just started dating my wife, and she was kind of taken, not taken aback, but curious as to why I was so passionate about the Saints. And she came to that game with me, and when it was over, she actually, and it was New Year's Eve, of course, so it was a great date night, but she looked at me and she said, "I understand, baby. I understand." So,
yeah, I was right. I was standing under the goalpost when he did it, and I wanted to choke him before I saw that the flag was thrown when it was blocked. And, yes, I have very much remember that game.
That's back when we used to leave games with headaches from screaming so loud. It was a defense-dominated Superdome, and we felt like helping the defense included making noise. And I've still got a photo in my Ricky Jackson jersey walking up the stairs with my hands in the air like a, you know, fifth raise. My face is red from yelling so much. But the thing that really I'll never forget is that sound. The first kick, it was poof.
Yeah.
You know, the kick and then hearing the block and just your heart falls out, and then seeing the flag. It was just it's still my all-time favorite Saints game for several reasons, but those are the two that popped to mind for me when you started your little project.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Joey. Appreciate it. By the way, Horace was correct. It was 93. The Saints won 16-13, and it was not the game I was thinking of. Steve Young was the quarterback the whole game, and he got sacked 5 times. That's awesome. And intercepted once. And, yeah, the Saints won 16-13. So that was the win at home to move to 4-0 in the season. 2 games before the blueprint game, which we don't want to talk about. We'll take a commercial break, finish out the show next, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to Footnotes. Kevin Foote, 103.7 The Game. Want to remind you, live entertainment is beginning again after a year of not much of it to none of it. And the Le Bon Temps Roulet music TV show is returning to KDCG. Live taping for the first episode is going to take place tonight at Pont Bros Cajun Restaurant featuring Donnie Broussard and the Louisiana Stars. It's a free show. Starts at 7 o'clock. You can get more information by going to KDCG.com. All right, so we are going to go into this series. We started like we've been doing with the Astros, and Astros will play the Red Sox tonight. If they get the sweep, it'll be very interesting because you would go 6-1 in the season series against a very good team who, again, lately when the Red Sox played, they just got finished sweeping the Yankees. So at Yankee Stadium, and they've been playing very well, but for whatever reason, the Astros have played very well against them. So I kind of thought they'd lose last night, and they ended up winning pretty comfortably. So it'll be very interesting to see what they do in this game, because then they go play the Twins. Now, you say, well, that's great. And the Twins have been really struggling, but remember, the Astros have played really well against the good teams this year. We talked a little bit about that with Chandler when he came on Monday. And they got swept at Texas, who's a last-place team. They got swept at Colorado, which is no longer a last-place team because of how bad the Diamondbacks have been playing. But at the time, they were in last place. And they got swept by the Tigers, who are no longer in last place. But at the time, they were in last place. So it was kind of crazy. By the way, speaking of that Tigers series, kind of strange the way it's worked out. You know, if you look at the people who were involved on, you know, in that 17 sign stealing fiasco with the Astros, AJ Hinch is now the manager of the Tigers. And when they played the Astros, they completely dominated the series. Cora was part of it, and he is now the Red Sox manager. And when the Astros have played the Red Sox this year, the Astros have completely dominated the Red Sox so far in this, you know, winning five of the six games. So, and they haven't hit at all except for that one game. They only got four hits. They did a great job of getting three runs out of the four hits. But they only had like one or two guys left on base all of last night. They didn't even hardly have any base runs. So it's interesting how all these different people, when they're playing each other, that stems from that, like there's total domination and kind of makes you go, I don't know. I don't know if any of that means anything, but it kind of curious results in that little weird triangle there. All right. Appreciate the phone calls we had today and the discussion on the cheating. It's a fascinating one to me. And lots of gray areas. Y'all have a nice day.